Thanks for coming back to the latest episode of the Credit Clubhouse. We are your one-stop shop for all things credit. Before we jump into our next episode, we have an exclusive offer for our listeners. If you're interested in attending any of our conferences throughout the year, we have a great deal for you. Just head to www.dealcatalyst.io, pick the event you want to attend, and enter the promo code CREDIT at checkout. This will give you 10% off any ticket to any conference. As always, don't forget to follow the show, rate us, and leave a review. We encourage your feedback. It'll help us make these episodes a better listen for you. And now, on to our next episode. Welcome back to our latest installment of the Credit Clubhouse. As always, I'm your host, Todd Anderson, Head of Content and Programming at Deal Catalyst. Joining me today is Neil Prunier, Managing Director, Industry Affairs for the Institutional Limited Partners Association, or ILPA. Thank you for joining me today, Neil. Great to meet you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me. Really, really looking forward to this conversation here.
Well, I appreciate your time. And, you know, just to kick off, obviously, you know, today we live in a bit of a chaotic time. It seems like every day is a bit of a crazy news cycle. Even today, we've now seen that there is a new pope. So it seems something is, you know, certainly on the news every day. But, you know, when it comes to the members of ILPA, do times like this, chaotic markets, tend to lead to more engagement, more questions? Are they coming to you for more things in these types of times?
Sure. I think realistically, yes, they are. And that's something that we pride ourselves as ILPA being able to provide to our members is greater resources, greater support during times of stress and different heightened anxiety. Realistically speaking, though, you know, there's always something new happening in the industry. So even when markets are going well, that can create some challenges that LPs want to have resources for and want to see ILPA be able to help address. So, you know, right now, working through different challenges as an industry, especially on the private equity side, with low distributions. But if we rewind a couple years, there were stronger distributions, but we were also operating in an environment where fundraising was happening at a clip that has never been seen before and at a size that had never been seen before. So even though it was, you know, strong performance and folks were feeling good, we were having a lot of conversations with our members because of that dynamic with the pace of fundraising. So yes, right now we're certainly trying to rise to the moment and meet the needs among the membership. But even during smoother times, there's always something going on in this dynamic space.
So when it comes to kind of some of the common themes from members today, I mean, obviously risk return is probably always a common theme. But are you hearing more things about some of the macroeconomic risks, maybe some of the new strategies out there? Private credit has certainly been a popular term, you know, the last couple of years. Regulatory updates, is there kind of a common theme amongst members right now?
As we think about the biggest questions from members, you know, the first point to highlight here is that there's, at the macro level, LPs aren't necessarily a monolith. So there will be different views between LPs as we think about big versus small or US versus ex-US. And as we then take it a level further, looking within organizations, there can be different views talking to the private credit team versus the private equity team. If we look at this from the macro standpoint, what our members are really focused in right now across private markets are some of the macroeconomic risks, are some of the global uncertainty that we've been experiencing in 2025. Heading into the year, there was the hope that there would be a pickup in deal activity, that we would experience some tailwinds that would help increase the flow of pure exit-driven distributions. And that hasn't fully played out. And that then in turn has cascading impacts as it relates to the risk return profile, as it relates to cash management for upcoming fundraising and just the entire liquidity profile. We've been talking to our members about this a lot. And something that's been really interesting to see is that members really do still prefer real exits on the private equity side. And what I mean by that, and the important caveat in that is, even if that comes at a slight of a haircut today, and so LPs want to see GPs hold on to those star assets, but LPs also prefer traditional exits, even slightly below marks, over some of the other alternative methods for exits, such as continuation vehicles or some of the other alternative methods for providing distributions and liquidity, such as NAV-based facilities.
Why is that? Just to pick up on that point, is there like a common reason why they prefer that, even if it is at a slight haircut?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think it's both about the exits, but then also about some of the other options. So if we look at continuation vehicles, the reality is, and there's been improvements in transparency based off of some guidance that ILPA put out on the topic back in 2023, but we're still in a situation where about 85% of LPs, roughly speaking, are exiting and not rolling into the fund or rolling into the continuation vehicle. Only about 15% are. And these might be star assets that LPs really wanted to be a part of, and signed up to be a part of, and had been supporting from day one with this fund. And now that's no longer part of the portfolio. So LPs don't like continuation funds by default in that capacity. And then with NAV facilities, this is something that has gotten, in some cases, has left a bad taste in LP's mouth, especially when used for early distributions. And so LPs do have a preference to see the true exits because of, some of these alternatives being less desirable.
And we'll jump into a little bit more on NAV facilities later, but maybe just as you've kind of gotten into the market a little bit, but like where is ILPA today in terms of what do the members look like? Where are they? Maybe just a bit of a full scope on kind of who the members are as we sit here today.
Sure. So we as ILPA, the Institutional Limited Partners Association, have been operating for over 21 years now. So I like to joke that we're now legally allowed to drink here in the States as an organization. And our geographic split follows that roughly of the private markets industry more broadly. So we're 60, 65% North American, 20, 25% Europe, 10, 15% Europe, or excuse me, 10, 15% Asia. And then the Middle East, and then the rest of the world. We then also have, as we think about our membership types, a good split between private and public pensions, insurance companies, endowments and foundations, high net worth, as well as sovereign wealth funds. If you can think about the typical types of investors, they're the typical ILPA members. So we do have good diversification across geographies and across the types that does roughly follow the broader markets. We as ILPA, as we think about engaging with our members in the private markets community more broadly, but we serve our members directly through three primary areas, that being education, the second being events that we put on and other networking and peer-to-peer opportunities. And the third is where I sit within the organization. That's our standards and industry affairs. So the way I describe this third area is being able to focus on how can we improve the industry from a bottoms-up standards and best practices space, as well as from a top-down legal, regulatory affairs, and policy space. When we think about our work within standards and the best practices, we really focus hard on the themes of transparency, governance, and alignment of interest. We think that those three core elements are absolutely fundamental to the longstanding historical success of the private equity, private market space, as well as the future success.
So you referenced NAV facilities a few moments ago, and clearly broader fund finance has really taken off. It seems the last couple of years in particular, it's a growth area for us. We've hosted events on it. We have your colleague Jeannie is going to be speaking at our New York event, and I know that you guys have put out some guidance on NAV facilities as well. Where would you say your members are with NAB facilities and even some of the other fund finance products? Because I know previously you've put out some materials on sublines. I think that was back in 2020. So maybe give us an understanding of kind of where they sit with some of these products today.
Sure. So I'll first focus on sublines. And, you know, that is something that at this point, I think all LPs recognize are omnipresent. You're going to be more surprised if a fund isn't using a subline than if it is. And so they're ubiquitous. We've done some polling and data collection from our members that indicate roughly 95%+ of funds are using sublines. I think LPs recognize this and understand that this is just the way the world works. I think there are some frustrations from LPs, especially now that we're in a higher interest rate environment. When we were in a lower interest rate environment and the idea of simplifying the capital call process, it made a lot of sense because it wasn't really costing LPs a lot. In today's environment, what we're hearing from LPs is that on a quarterly basis, the interest charge associated with sublines can be the single biggest charge that they face, even bigger than that of a management fee. And so when we think about it from the LP perspective, it's beneficial to have these sublines in place. You know, they help operationally with the reduction in the number of capital calls that you're going to experience. However, I don't think that LPs are fully seeing the benefits that they would like to see. So, for example, I think there'd be a lot of improvements that could be made if LPs were able to get even further insight into anticipated future capital calls. If you know that this subline is going to get paid down every 3, every 6 months, being able to give LPs at the very least directional information about when they can anticipate future capital calls without that needing to be something that LPs request and reach out for. So I still do think that there's some areas for improvement sorry, did you get that doorbell?
It was, yeah, I mean, that's okay.
There's areas for improvement with transparency associated with subscription lines of credit, where I think LPs would feel better about how ubiquitous they are and have some of the additional value accrue to them. On the point of NAB-based facilities, and I don't mean this to be an overtly negative sentiment towards some of these fund finance products, because I do think that they play an important role in the industry, but we did some very recent polling of our members, and 65% had a negative view on NAB-based facilities, and only 8% had a positive view. And I think this is for a few reasons. And again, much like LPs aren't a monolith, I recognize that GPs aren't a monolith either. But as it comes to the NAB-based facilities, I think especially as they picked up in use the last several years, there were some bad actors on the GP side from a communication, from a transparency standpoint, that have made LPs feel more negative towards NAB-based facilities. And this is because there wasn't any transparency about the use of NAB facilities. LPs have at times a misconception that an overwhelming volume of NAB facilities are being used for early distributions, whereas data points that that is typically less than 5% of the use case.
Yeah.
But LPs have this perception because that at times is the only type of NAB facility that they are being informed about, because they're seeing it in a distribution notice. And so these other types of NAB facilities are only finding out about after the fact, if at all. And what we would like to do is to see even greater transparency as part of this process. And then in certain cases, based off of LPA language and how it's structured, you know, involvement of the LPAC. But at the heart of some of these negative sentiments from LPs, I think, is how it's been conducted within some GP organizations, and at times a complete lack of transparency and communication related to an upcoming or even after the fact use of a NAB facility.
What would be, you know, some of the motivation from a GP? Like, why wouldn't they be more transparent about this? Is it just things are moving fast and they just use these products because you know, they need to at times, and it's, you know, it kind of cuts down on, all right, I have to go to LPs and I have to do all this back and forth. Like, what would be some of the motivation? Because in theory, it seems pretty simple. Like, all right, let's let the LPs know we're going to use these products. We're not asking for permission. We're just giving them insight. Like, where I guess is the kind of the holdup in that simplification of a process?
Yeah. And so one thing just I do want to highlight, you know, there have been GPs have done really good with this and have brought it to LPAC for thoughts and for permission. And in some cases, the LPAC have said, no, perhaps we don't think this makes the most sense. And the GPE said, okay, yeah, perhaps we try something different. So there have been a number of GPs that are doing this the right way. I think the unfortunate reality is, unless something at times is contractually required within the LPA, it's not always being provided. And I highlighted my role and the standards focus here at ILPA is from a bottoms up. Often what we're doing is to try to put guardrails in place for new behavior that comes up where there isn't necessarily industry best practices and it's not as clearly dictated in the LPA as one would like. So there are times where because it's not specifically spelled out and because it's not a part of standard quarterly reporting packages today, that the transparency and the communication about it is zero realistically. And that's what we wanted to try to solve for with our guidance to be able to increase the amount of transparency and communication about it. I highlighted the themes of alignment of interest, governance, and transparency. We promote these because ideally, they would help solve for some of these scenarios themselves, where if you do feel really strongly about the idea of transparency and alignment of interest, and you're using this new tool, you would think you would communicate with your LPs about it. But what we're seeing in practice is that that's not always the case. And that's why ILPA does need to come in and work across the industry with LPs, GPs, and service providers to put out things like our NAV guidance or the subline guidance or the continuation funds guidance.
You put out the NAV guidance, I think, a few months ago. Have you seen kind of a beginning part of shift? And maybe the subline's the better example. Like, when you put that out, now it's been some years. Like, is the education gap, is the the GP behavior, has that shifted a good amount from the time when you put that initial guidance out to where we sit here today? And are you hopefully expecting a similar, you know, kind of turn on NAV facilities when, you know, we get to 2 years from now, so to speak?
Yeah, I think in some cases, yes, and in some cases, no. So for example, with subscription lines, I think there is the communication about them as far as how and when they're getting used. But there's not as much proactive communication about the amount outstanding on the line. As I highlighted before, the ability to provide even more proactive thoughts that would help LPs with cash management as far as anticipated future distributions. And then up until some of our recent changes and new releases with our ILPA reporting template and ILPA performance template, there hasn't been as much quarterly reporting on fees and expenses related to the interests and other expenses with the subline, or some of the with and without performance figures. So we have seen some behavior change, but there hadn't been as much on the transparency front. And that's one of the reasons why we made that a point of emphasis with the templates that we had just released earlier this year as well. On the point of NAV facilities, I think the guidance we put out, as well as the ongoing conversations, have started to shift the needle as far as education and awareness. It has also started to improve the dialogue. You know, for us, one of the benefits with our members of having this guidance out there is there can't be the retort of, you're the only group asking for this. Because if it's in our guidance, it's something that is a consensus and something that a lot of LPs really want to see. Yeah. So we have seen some improvements as far as the amount of transparency and conversation with NAV facilities, and have seen it be more clearly outlined in the LPA. However, sometimes in getting more clear outlining in the LPA, it is the end result can be that There's even greater freedom for GPs to do what they like, whereas LPs might not necessarily want that. So as we think about NAV facilities and what we want to keep pushing for and what we're going to continue to try to have wider adoption in the industry with our guidance is the theme of transparency, especially on key elements like rationale. Why did you decide to do a NAV facility as opposed to something else? What is it being used for, and how is it being deployed? Things like that are really important for LPs to know. For example, that use case I mentioned before, one of the reasons why LPs don't like NAV facilities to be used for early distributions is that they can typically get a loan on their own at a lower interest rate than that of the NAV facility. And so if a GP is saying, oh, we know distributions are tough, we want to give you this distribution now, well, LPs are actually paying for that in the interest charges, and it's costing them more than if they were to take a loan out on their own. And so, other use cases as far as reinvesting in portfolio companies, well, LPs want to understand, is this because there was poor cash management and how the, capital was deployed early in the life of this fund versus is this really the best decision and the best possible outcome for that particular asset? And that's where it should be a strong partnership between LPs and GPs. And transparency and communication is such a big element of that.
Do you think the and kind of the last point on the NAV and fund finance products, can the LPs kind of take back the power, so to speak, and kind of collectively really start imprinting this? Like it needs to be in the LPA and it needs to, we need to see this in the documentation, or hey, we won't allocate to you. And I know it's not, as you said, they're not a monolith, so not everyone's going to act the same, but collectively, if that starts to happen, along with your guidance, maybe the needle shifts quicker.
Yeah, so and that's a great question, and I'll say that from and not just one or two, from a number of LPs we've talked about or have talked to, they've identified that they've had such a poor experience with a NAV facility that they will not be re-upping with the GP as a result. So the biggest power that the LPs have is voting with their feet. And so if there are these frustrations that LPs are experiencing, yes, we are seeing and hearing that impact future re-ups with a GP. I think the challenge for LPs is the language in the LP related to NAV facilities going to be what I walk away from a top quartile GP over? Maybe, maybe not. And that's the reality of the tough position LPs are in from a negotiating standpoint, from the leverage that they may or may not have in a given negotiation. So this is a point that's very important to LPs to start seeing more clearly and push for greater protections and more transparency in LPAs and inside letters as necessary. But this isn't necessarily the number one, number two must have item that will cause LPs to walk away in all cases. But I can tell you some LPs have had such a bad experience that they will no longer be investing in a GP going forward.
Yeah, another buzzword the last few years has been private credit. I know that you guys have been a more private equity focused organization, from your history, but you're starting to kind of field a lot more questions. What are some of the strategies within the private credit bucket? What does that look like comparatively speaking to private equity? Like what is, 'cause from our point of view, we cover credit to a great deal across our portfolio. And so curious to understand kind of where you guys are with private credit and where the members are starting to look.
Yeah, that's a great question as well. And historically there had been a much greater focus on private equity. And I think realistically that's still where we do our most work and focus on most directly. But we have gotten increasingly involved in a few other spaces. And one of them is private credit. We've been offering, for example, a private credit course to our members for the last several years now. And that is a very popular course amongst the membership. We've got a number of members who have dedicated private credit teams, but then also a high proportion of our members who have one team that focus on private equity and private credit. So we are providing additional education in formal classroom type settings. We also have our members conference coming up the first week of June, and we'll be having a workshop on Private Credit 201 to go even deeper into the themes of private credit and different types of investments between investment grade, sub-investment grade, the growth in the space and ways to take advantage of the current opportunities as well as the ways to mitigate risk. So it is a topic that features prominently in our various events, and it is something that we are constantly looking at as it relates to some of the other work that we do in the standards and best practices space as well. There are some areas that overlap as far as those themes of alignment of interest, transparency, and governance between private credit and private equity, but there's a different lens that you have to come at it from based off of the nature of the investments and based off of some of the particular points. So, for example, we did just put out our ILPA reporting template for Phoenix expense data, and we highlight that this is realistically made for private equity because we don't have all the specific partnership expenses one would expect to see to cover all the private credit type expenses. However, on our performance template that we released, this is really suitable for any closed-end fund that uses IRR, whether it's private equity or private credit or real estate or venture, based off of the mechanics of the transaction types and how the calculations play out in the closed-end IRR space. So we do try to call out when things are specific for one space versus the other. And we are always looking at how we can get even more involved in some of these other spaces because our members are increasingly more involved in these other spaces.
Are there any other strategies that you've kind of started to hear from members? Obviously, we've covered a few of the main ones, but are there any other kind of niche or kind of a second question on that? What does it look like when someone comes to you with something that might be fresh or new? And how does that process work to kind of maybe begin to get out some further understanding or guidance around that?
Yeah, sure. So, on the first part, I think this is something of keen interest, especially as we think about some of the geographic split. So, for example, different strategies and focus related to climate transition and decarbonization, that is much more mainstream in Europe, as well as from some of our Canadian members. And so that's something that we focus on to be able to support them and generate conversations. There's certainly folks that are very engaged and interested in that in the United States, but there's the current political environment there that everybody is navigating right now. So there are different strategies that we see coming up. We had a session at a recent event as well on the topic of growing the LP toolbox because of the theme that it's really never been more difficult to be an LP. There aren't the guaranteed 20% IRRs of years in the past. And now you have to be more skilled at navigating the channels with NAV facilities and being familiar with these fund finance concepts, but then also co-investments, LP secondaries, continuation funds, moving to the mid-market, looking at sector-specific funds rather than some of the global multi-strat massive funds. And so there are a lot of different dynamics playing out here that LPs need to be aware of. I highlighted it a little bit in the response just there, but not necessarily a new strategy, but we are seeing more and more LPs interested in the mid-market and what that can represent, as well as some sector-specific and geographic-specific GPs, given their ability to have stronger thesis and ability to deliver returns during challenging environments.
So before we get to some of the fun questions, as we wrap up, I saw that you guys had released your inaugural limited partner sentiment survey, What were some of the key things coming out of that? Anything that was like really surprising to you as you start to kind of hear some of this even more direct feedback from members?
Yeah, so we've mentioned a few times that it's been a difficult investment environment the last several years. And one of the things that's been of interest and that we've been paying really, really close attention to is the idea of negotiating leverage. And folks at times talk about the pendulum swinging from one side to the other, and it's in the GP's favors when returns are great and distributions are flowing, and it's in the LP's favor when the fundraising environment is tough. And while there have been some improvements for LPs, given how tough of an environment it currently is, the shift hasn't been as far as one would expect it to be to the LP's favor. And I think that's just a testament to some of the inherent challenges that LPs face in the negotiating process, and some of the lack of leverage that they have due to the structural dynamics in play between GPs and LPs and external counsel from both sides of the organization. So this is something that's near and dear to us to see how we can help improve the negotiating process for all parties in the industry, because I know GPs have their own pain points about how LPs show up, and likewise. So this is something that we're focused on to see how we can try to positively influence the dynamics. To create just a better process overall for LPs and GPs. I mentioned that some LPs have walked away because of the NAV facilities. Realistically speaking, some LPs have walked away because of how contentious the LPA negotiations have become. And that's challenging to think about because this is supposed to be a partnership that you're engaging in. And signing the documents to be connected for 10, if not at this point, 15 years. And it has been a very challenging dynamic the last several years.
Well, I really appreciate you spending time with us here, Neil. So a few fun questions as we kind of get out the door. Favorite sports team or hobby?
Sure. So, my favorite sports team is the Boston Red Sox. So I've had the good fortune of seeing a few World Series championships these last since the turn of the century, starting in 2024, or excuse me, starting in 2004, not 2024 wasn't a great season by any means. So that's been a really rewarding experience. And then from a hobby standpoint, I do have, about 75 indoor plants. And so I do a lot of plant work at home.
Tell us why I think that might lead to the next question, but maybe you'll have something different. One surprising thing about yourself.
That's a great question. So one surprising thing about myself, I think I will go with the good old plants. So I've got very into data, if you haven't told, love operations and standards. So I've got an Excel spreadsheet set up to track when I last watered everything and when I next need to water everything. And it keeps me on track of what I need to do because I can't remember everything across all 75 of the plants.
And what drew you to plant in the first place?
So for a while I was living in an English basement, so below ground here in Washington, D.C., that only got limited light. So I took it as a challenge to see how well I could do with a handful of plants. And then a few years ago, I moved to the above ground in a condo that has a lot of windows and great sun. So since then, I've really just blossomed with the number of plants. I try to cut back. It is difficult when my wife and I go out of town,
I can
especially for
imagine.
more than a week or so. So I've got that spreadsheet comes in handy with some friends that have been very kind to come by and water once or twice. But it's been a growing habit and a growing hobby over these last several years.
One book you'd recommend the listeners read.
Sure. I think a book that's had a lasting impact on me is Good to Great. That's something that first read probably about 10, 15 years ago at this point. And have really used that as part of kind of my ongoing leadership development, as well as strategy and looking at an organization and even the industry as a whole.
I'm looking at a copy of it right there.
Oh, great.
What's the most exciting part of your job?
You mentioned this a little bit before, but I do really love how dynamic it is. There's always something new happening. That's one of the biggest challenges of the job is that there's never necessarily a calm moment. There's always something new we've got to be on the lookout for, always a new way for us to be engaging with our members and to support them and to support the broader private equity industry and private market industry. So just never having a dull moment and being able to work through some of these challenges with some of the brightest minds, talking to LPs, GPs, service providers, to try to come to solutions for the industry as a whole.
And then final question, one prediction for the next year.
Sure. So as much as there was optimism coming into this year, I do think there's going to continue to be some challenges with distributions throughout the remainder of this year and as we turn into 2026, and that this is going to be an ongoing point of conversation between LPs and and GPs. I think right now LPs can handle, it's not ideal, but you know, are managing through this low level of distribution. I think as we turn to 2026, if this continues to be the trend, then it starts to become a little bit more problematic. So really looking out for this because of what the impact will be for our members and the broader industry.
Well, Neil, I really appreciate you spending some time with us. I've appreciated working with some of your colleagues on some of our events. And so best wishes to you. Continued luck with your plans. And look forward to catching up again sometime soon.
Thanks so much, Todd. Really
Thank
appreciate
you.
it.